In 3, 2, 1. The Firefighters Association wants an independent, impartial 3-member panel to take a good look at the fire department's operation. Association member Bill Howe told the city council this week that even though the number of personnel has dropped over the years, operating policies have not changed.
The consequence is the fire department continues to pursue an unsafe and oftentimes irrational level of service that forces the firefighters into life-threatening situations unnecessarily.
Howe says it's not a matter of asking for more people. The association has given up on that request. He says he simply wants to be able to work more safely with the few people who are left. Howe wants a panel to look at the department operation and suggest any changes that may be needed to ensure safety. City Manager Brian Phillips says the fire chief reports regularly about safety concerns. The council was asked to look at the problem earlier this year after a fire in February and another in April.
And that was the basis of the April study session, which brought forward the information on this particular fire. The fact that there was no backup, the fact that the firefighter was in without a backup hose, that the structure was imminently failing, and there was no backup to pull that firefighter out. It almost cost the firefighter's life. And we went in that in some detail, and we spent about an hour on the subject. Some of the other issues that we're talking about primarily pertain to equipment and manning on the equipment. We're going to recommend management changes in the 1990 budget, which will be coming forward in 3 months. But some of the other areas that Bill may be talking about, I may not be aware of.
Phillips says the management changes being considered for the upcoming budget might address the concerns of the Firefighters Association. The city council members plan to take a closer look at the problem next month. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
The question of money and how to keep the ICC financially sound has been a major topic in private caucuses held by each delegation. For years, the North Slope Borough has provided much of the money for the Inuit Circumpolar Conference, but that changed over a year ago. North Slope Borough Mayor Georgia Malik told the ICC that the oil dollars are not pouring in.
Times are changing for us. Most everyone is aware of the economic slump suffered by the oil industry. Trudeau Bay is about to enter a period of decline. In short, while we remain economically strong, the borough can no longer afford to be the sole supporter or near sole supporter of any organization extending beyond our boundaries.
Like Canada and Greenland, Alaska will give $300,000 in the next fiscal year. Bering Strait Native Corporation Chairman Lonnie O'Connor says that's up from the $200,000 from a year ago.
Each region is broken into four regions, and each region would be responsible for raising approximately $50,000 each. And that would be left to each region internally to raise that money is what we had in our caucus. And then the other $100,000 is already coming from the North Slope Borough.
O'Connor says the funding issue is the one item that has caused dissent among the Alaska delegation.
Because there are some organizations that are short of money, and like we were short of money in the past years at Bering Strait, and now we've, you know, solved that problem. And that's the only difference that I see.
Of course, it is up to each corporation to approve the regional fundraising. O'Connor says the Bering Strait Native Corporation, which only recently got out of Chapter 11 bankruptcy proceedings, finally has the money to contribute towards the ICC. But O'Connor said no corporation member will run for a position on the ICC Executive Council. The two Alaskan seats are up for election this week. So far, candidates are Daley Sambo, an ICC staff member, Edna McLean of Barrow, and Mary Schaefer of Kotzebue. I'm Claire Richardson in Simiyu's Greenland.
The planes were flown up in a series of hops and jumps from Great Falls, Montana to Fairbanks. Here, ground crews painted them with the Soviet star, and Soviet combat pilots had just a few days to learn how the planes worked before they flew them back to fight with Germany.
Well, there was 7,000 and some odd aircraft of the P-39 and the King Cobra and the Arrow Cobra that were sent over there. These are fighters. There was a large group of C-47s, which is the old DC-3, and there was quite a number of the B-25 Mitchell bombers, the light, medium-sized bomber We didn't give them any heavy bombers. We didn't give them the B-17s and B-24s.
Everett Long works for the crash and rescue crew at the Fairbanks International Airport. He's also part of the Interior and Arctic Alaska Aeronautical Foundation. That's the group that's trying to contact as many of the World War II Lend-Lease pilots and ground crews as possible. Word is out through American, Canadian, and Soviet newspapers, but the group still has no idea how many people they're looking for this reunion, so there's still a big job ahead.
And anyone who knows of any pilot who has participated in the 7th Ferry Command, that was the group of American pilots that flew from Great Falls up through Canada to Fairbanks, those people need to contact.
The reunion is planned in Fairbanks for the summer of 1992, 50 years after the first plane was leased to the Soviet Union. And there's been a recent breakthrough. Long has just gotten a letter from Mikhail Makin, the Soviet general who was in Fairbanks from 1942 to 1944. He was in charge of the whole Soviet operation in Fairbanks, and Makin says he's willing to work on the project from the Soviet end. If it all comes off, hundreds or thousands of pilots may get to Fairbanks in June of 1992. There's an air show and demonstration of some of the old warplanes planned, but the old P-39s probably won't be flown by the pilots that brought them into Fairbanks in the first place. I'm Robin Martin.
The guarantee is very clear that Exxon will stay until the job is done right and that they intend to do that and they're committed to do that. We expect them to live up to that. Maybe we're a little too old-fashioned in Alaska, but the two principles that we think still operate here are if you make a promise, you ought to keep it, and if you make a mess, you ought to clean it up. And if Exxon can't live by those, then it seems to me we ought to take a look at the rules under which they operate.
It is approximately 50 to 60% complete. The scheduled final completion date is March 4, 1990. And the contractor appears to be on or perhaps a little bit ahead of schedule.
3, 2, 1. A group called Allvest wants to turn the Borealis Hotel into a private correctional center to compete for the contract the Fairbanks Alternative Placement Center now holds. The Anchorage-based company wanted the borough assembly to agree that the facility would constitute a group home, thereby overruling a borough administrative decision that the center is not a group home, but a penal institute. Bill Weimer is president of Allvest.
We're not a penal institution, quote, necessitating restraint. We do not restrain people. If they want to leave, they can leave. If they do that, we call the police or the other authorities. We're a community residential facility. We're not a jail.
But the borough's Department of Community Planning does not agree. Spokesman Bernardo Hernandez says a group home is designed for a family atmosphere.
If you look at the situation here, we're talking about 65 inmates. That hardly provides for a family situation.
The assembly also heard testimony from more than a dozen residents of the area, all of whom agreed that the facility would be a prison, not a group home. The assembly voted to uphold the original decision. If Allvest is still interested in the property, it must now request a conditional use permit. That will mean a public hearing on the subject and possibly even more opposition. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson.
2, 1. His story is that he's a victim of cancer himself, and he's done long-distance runs to prove that cancer doesn't have to be debilitating. But now the noble cause is overshadowed by crime. The Westmark Hotel in Fairbanks has been built out of about $500, and several local businesses allegedly sold Figueroa items on a stolen credit card. And now Fairbanks detective Paul Keller says police have put out a warrant for the arrest of Louis Michael Figueroa and set bail for $5,000.
And he fled Alaska. We know on foot, wearing blue running tights, white T-shirt with Nike across the front and a pair of Nike tennis shoes. And he was last seen in the North Pole area where a lady gave him a ride, and he was continuing with the story that he was running for the American Cancer Society and he was heading for Key West, Florida.
Keller says the runner left his clothes behind at the hotel in Fairbanks. He told the driver who picked him up he was meeting friends in North Pole. But Keller thinks Figueroa is on his own.
To my knowledge, there is no support crew. Once he got here, he told everybody he was going to do this run, but he hadn't planned it out at all. There was no planning done in ahead of time. He just came up here and used it as a story to stay for free in the hotel. And I guess get free meals and tour around Fairbanks for a week.
Police and reporters in Fairbanks have been unable to confirm any of Figueroa's claims of corporate sponsorship from Delta Airlines, Athletics West, Nike, or Westmark and Best Western Hotels. Keller says he's checking airlines' manifests, but at this point he doesn't know how Figueroa got into the state.
We can't confirm, even if he had Hodgkin's disease, which he told us that he had. He claims to be a world-class marathoner, runs times as low as 2 hours and 11 minutes. Has run the Olympic trials as fast as 2 hours and 17 minutes. None of that can be confirmed to be true.
Keller says he's particularly interested in the case because he's a runner himself. He says there's nothing illegal about running to raise money for the Cancer Society, and Figueroa has actually protected himself from federal fraud charges by asking supporters to send their money directly to the society and not to him. In an interview earlier this week, Figueroa told reporters his support team was a little late getting to Fairbanks in their motorhome, and Figueroa was apparently looking forward to staying in hotels.
I'll be in the RV for the beginning of the run because the Yukon Territory, there's going to be places where there's no place to stay. After that, it's state troopers will be watching us along the way, and we'll be staying at Westmark and Best Westerns.
You're going to have press conferences all the way?
Yeah, and the way we plan to raise money was just ask people to donate to the local American Cancer Society, so no money goes through us, and we ask on the checks that they write the memo Run Against Cancer, and that's how we know American Cancer Society will get back to us and let us know actually how much we generated.
The local chapter of the American Cancer Society was taken by surprise when they heard a fundraising runner was in town. They thought they had dropped the ball somewhere in a national campaign, so they called offices in Anchorage, Atlanta, and New York, but no one knew about Figueroa's cross-country run. Louis Michael Figueroa is still at large, and police and troopers will be following him. They suspect he is hitchhiking to the Canadian border. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin Martin. Figueroa, a fake update for the 28th of July. His story is that he's a victim of cancer himself, and he's done long-distance runs to prove that cancer doesn't have to be debilitating. But now the noble cause is overshadowed by crime. The Westmark Hotel in Fairbanks has been built out of about $500, and several local businesses allegedly sold Figueroa several items on a stolen credit card. And now Figueroa is in Fairbanks Correctional Center on a charge of second-degree theft, and bail has been set for $5,000. Police say Figueroa was picked up by the Alaska State Troopers in Delta last night. Sergeant J.L. Wilt of the Fairbanks Police Department says news reports of the false fundraising Figueroa led citizens in the area to call the police.
We had a number of phone calls, people that had sighted him, and also a call from someone that had transported him to Delta. I don't know who called from Delta indicating where he was or if that information was found out by the troopers working in the Delta area.
Welch said he's glad for the assistance from the public. Figueroa came to Fairbanks on the 22nd of July and was seen running from the Westmark Hotel in Fairbanks on Wednesday. Police say he left his clothes behind at the hotel in Fairbanks, and he was seen hitchhiking along the Richardson Highway. He told the driver who picked him up that he was meeting friends farther down the road. Police were first called by the Westmark Hotel when they reported that Figueroa didn't pay his hotel bill. Police and reporters had been unable to confirm any of Figueroa's claims of corporate sponsorship from Delta Airlines, Athletics West, Nike, or Westmark and Best Western Hotels. Police Detective Paul Keller says he's checking airlines' manifests now, but at this point, he doesn't even know how Figueroa got into the state.
We can't confirm, even if he had Hodgkin's disease, which he told us that he had. He claims to be a world-class marathoner, runs times as low as 2 hours and 11 minutes. Has run the Olympic trials as fast as 2 hours and 17 minutes. None of that can be confirmed to be true.
Keller says there's nothing illegal about running to raise money for the Cancer Society, and Figueroa has protected himself from federal fraud charges by asking supporters to send their money directly to the society and not to him. In an interview earlier this week, Figueroa told reporters his support team was a little late getting to Fairbanks in their motorhome, and Figueroa was apparently looking forward to staying in hotels.
I'll be in the RV for the beginning of the run because the Yukon Territory, there's going to be places where there's no place to stay. After that, it's state troopers will be watching us along the way, and we'll be staying at Westmark and Best Westerns.
You're going to have press conferences all the way?
Yeah, and the way we plan to raise money, we just ask people to donate to the local American Cancer Society, so no money goes through us, and we ask on the checks that they write the memo Run Against Cancer. That's how we know. American Cancer Society will get back to us and let us know actually how much we generated.
The local chapter of the American Cancer Society was taken by surprise when they heard of a fundraising runner in town. They thought they had dropped the ball somewhere in a national campaign, so they called offices in Anchorage, Atlanta, and New York, but no one knew about Figueroa's cross-country run. Reporting for KUAC Local News, I'm Robin Martin.
3, 2, 1. The issues remain the same. Should the borough renovate the current administrator's offices in the old main building? That structure has heating, electrical, and asbestos problems. Should they purchase the Teamsters building or some other building that might be suitable? Or should a new structure be built? Borough Assembly members want to be able to take advantage of the fact that the state might reimburse the borough for 80% of the cost of whatever solution is chosen, if the state approves. Assembly members have recently stepped up the process of solving the problem since they want to get voters to approve any plan in the October election. The latest idea is to take letters from anyone with a building that might be suitable. The Borough Public Works Department can review those and look at possible costs that might be related to those structures. That would give voters a ballpark figure to approve in the fall. That plan has the support of Assemblymember Valerie Therian.
We want to kind of know what's out there and what's available, and that's exactly what this is going to provide us. And we've been tossing this around for months, and if people wanted to go through the long, expensive process, they should have started working on it in April instead of now.
Assemblymember Chris Birch feels that the voters will need more information than that most immediate solution will provide.
I guess my concern is I think we owe the voters the opportunity to know, you know, a specific site, a specific location, and some specifics.
And Jeff Weltzien was concerned about what he called a generic bond issue for voter approval. Weltzien says voters need more details, even though that may take a little longer.
For KIPP, the October 3rd election, go through the in-depth process, start now. For the next 2 months, we could conceivably have an election in special election in November of this fall.
But neither of those answers is suitable to the majority of assembly members. They still haven't reached a decision, and now four different proposals are basically on the table. Jerry Norum seems to think it's time to make some move.
I would hope that you would make the motion to simply put this on some kind of a schedule. It is the most ineptly handled issue in my 9 years around this place.
And if they decide to go after a new building, assembly members will face another decision. What about the main building? If they own it, can they sell it? And will they still have to remove the asbestos from the structure, even if they don't use it for office space? For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
What we've done is we've said this is what it would take, and this, you know, insofar as the planning, we think that three-year approach is by far the best approach, but once the money is appropriated to us, then we've got the plans on the shelf and we're ready to go. That's our approach to the project.
School board members are set to give final approval of a new no smoking policy. The new policy would prohibit smoking on all school property at all times. Currently, there are smoking areas at district buildings, but this plan would eliminate them. Also up for school board consideration is a resolution asking the Borough Assembly to take advantage of low real estate prices and purchase land for a new elementary school. The district's long-range plans call for a new school because enrollment is expected to climb in the next few years. The Board of Education is asking that suitable land be found now for a new elementary school that will house 600 students. Also before the school board tonight is the fiscal year 1991 capital budget that must be submitted to the State Department of Education. The six-year capital improvement plan lists 30 priorities of the school district. It represents the district's best effort to identify immediate and long-term building needs. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
At one point it was resentment from non-oil producing states. What are you feeling now, or what are you hearing now?
I think everybody's pretty much on the same wavelength. I think people understand that we have to produce energy in this country, and the trick is to do it right, to do it with no environmental impact if possible, and at the very least, with a minimal environmental impact. People recognize that you can't operate a nation as big as ours without fossil energy, at least at the moment, and that the thing to do is to make sure that the exploration and development that takes place not only in Alaska, but offshore in the other states as well, that be done with a minimum of environmental disruption.
Once they start finding out more about the effect that ICC has had on our lives in Alaska, I'm talking about fighting the anti-harvest animal rights people that want us to quit eating seals, and the effect that ICC has on and helping us with whaling issues, I think the people of Alaska will begin to realize that the importance of ICC and the role it plays for us.
There's no easy solution. I mean, garbage disposal costs money. Fairbanks, the garbage disposal fees are real low compared to anywhere else. That's not a real sympathetic argument for the public, though. I mean, when you double fees on somebody, they're going to feel it. But in order to do the things we have to run a landfill that doesn't have health and safety problems, we're going to have to figure out a way to fund it, and that's the way we figured out.
3-2-1. After 2 months of discussion, board members approved a strong no-smoking policy. Tobacco use will not be allowed in buildings, vehicles, or on any school property. There was another attempt at last night's board meeting to soften that change and allow smoking on property so that teachers could go outside to smoke. But most school board members feel that sets a bad example. They don't want people congregating just outside the doors. They feel that banning smoking in only buildings and vehicles would lead to that. Approval came despite opposition from the district principals, who feel it will cause morale problems, and teachers. Fairbanks Education Association President Carol Evans told the board the designated smoking areas that exist now solve the problem.
I do believe that imposing this unilateral change in working conditions would create problems rather than solve problems, and it is probable that our association would challenge the right to have these restrictions imposed.
Evans says an all-out ban would be a hardship for employees addicted to tobacco. School board members considered two legal issues: action by the teachers who smoke and don't want the change in working conditions, or possible action from a parent who sues because of the effects of secondhand smoke. School board president Mike Kramer.
And as far as I'm concerned, if somebody wants to sue us for protecting the health of children, then have a...
The new policy was approved by one vote, and its approval drew applause from the audience. It will take effect when school starts later this month. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
We had a creek running through the property, and it had an old swimming hole. And we used to talk about in the spring about a toe dipping. In other words, check it out. Is it time to go swimming? And I think we're going to see a tremendous amount of toe dipping in the gubernatorial waters between now and June 1st. It won't be as long a campaign. Obviously, the campaigns are not getting started as early, and I think it's been a function of the oil spill and the fact that Alaskans are just so involved and busy with really their own economic survival.
She sees a more concentrated.
I almost hate to use the term founding fathers, but it does fit the situation in that the founding fathers were also very concerned about the situation at the time, the social and economic situation, and we are too.
If you've driven from Anchorage to Fairbanks on the Parks Highway, you've seen some of the real estate in question here. A plan by the Mat-Su Borough to spread its boundaries north to this stretch of Alaska is being met with fierce resistance from property owners in the tiny towns of Cantwell, Anderson, and Healy. They're fighting back with a plan to form a borough of their own. This battle began 3 months ago and 200 miles away in Palmer when the Mat-Su Borough filed paperwork with the State Boundary Commission. Legal ads in the newspapers in Anchorage show the borough's proposal to annex a large part of Denali State Park and areas alongside the Alaska Railroad and the Parks Highway. Steve Jones is chairman of the Rail Belt Borough Planning Committee. He says there are some obvious reasons why they shouldn't be included in the Mat-Su Borough.
We're very far removed from them. There's
quite a hunk of road between where, like Trapper Creek and Cantwell. They're just spread too far, and their tax rates are extremely high.
Jones says more than 150 people have attended volunteer meetings in Healy and work sessions up and down the highway. The goal is to draw up a petition to compete with the Matt Suburo's proposal. But some of the basics are still missing. For one thing, the name of the jurisdiction. Organizer Everett Drashner of Cantwell says it will probably end up being called the Denali Borough, not Rail Belt. But while the Matt Su plan is well marked on the map, Drashner says people up north aren't even sure how big their borough will be.
At least for certain, it would be Cantwell, Healy, and Anderson, and might even include Nenana. We don't know for sure yet.
60 miles out of Fairbanks, at the edge of the North Star borough, Nenana could be the northern border of the new government. Drashner says people ask him at the meetings, why are you forming a borough when you don't really want one? He provides a simple answer.
The reason is because somebody is going to gobble us up if we don't do it ourselves.
Besides the Matt Su proposal, the area is also being eyed by the Fairbanks North Star borough. So what's the attraction? Well, there's much more here than mountains and caribou herds. There's a lot of cash floating around. The region skirts Mount McKinley National Park, and Steve Jones says steady growth in the tourism business over the years has made the area attractive for tax collectors.
So one of the primary reasons they want the area is because of the bed tax on tourism. There's a lot of money to be had and not many services to provide that aren't already in existence.
Petition organizers say the area could generate an estimated $300,000 a year in hotel taxes. The group has until October 27th to draw up its petition, get it signed, and mail it off to Juneau. In Anchorage, I'm Robert Hawk.
3-3-2-1. The manager of the borough's community research center says the real estate market seems to be more stable now than it has been over the last 3 years. Leslie Corvola says the number of houses listed for sale has decreased, while the average asking prices were up in March and April for the first time since 1985. Corvola says the rental market itself tells a story. The number of rental units advertised dropped by 200 between April and June to about half the number of units that were advertised during the same period of time last year.
Now, we recognize that sometimes there are fewer units advertised because either people are discouraged and don't want to advertise, but those have been in the marketplace all along. Some units have been taken out of the market because they went into foreclosures and so there's no one living in them, and that's taken a certain number out. But still, this is such a drastic decrease. We think it's a healthy sign that we may in fact be experiencing the turnaround.
The center's research also shows the number of single-family homes sold has steadily increased since 1986. Corvola says the center is cautious about making projections, but she says the population and economy are stabilizing, and that's good reason to think that the housing market will reflect that too. But she also warns that the military housing that will be available soon may cause people to leave their current civilian housing, and that will impact what would happen in the coming months. And she knows that there are people who would like to sell, but are reluctant to put their houses on the market because they feel they would be taking too great a loss. Corvola says whether or not that changes will depend on how rapidly the demand for housing recovers, but she is optimistic.
And we do think that overall we're seeing signs of stability, and that possibly this is the time for buyers to say, I want to buy now because it may not get better.
For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
There were two proposals given to me for review regarding how the department would operate at a fire. And the wording, though not entirely acceptable, certainly is conceptually in the direction that the association believes is correct.
System. Charlene Parent reports.
Right from the start, Exxon said only those directly involved with the fishing industry were eligible for compensation. To help those people through their loss of income this summer, interim payments have been made to salmon permit holders and cannery workers. But that policy doesn't extend to everyone who has suffered a direct impact from the spill. Unemployed crew members are not eligible for a claim, and if you happen to be a salmon fisherman who doesn't own a salmon fishing permit, you're out of luck. Tammy Golden and her husband own a 38-foot seine boat Normally, during salmon season, they lease a salmon permit. With no fishing this year, Golden went to the claims office for financial assistance. The claims officer told her he didn't have time to deal with her case. As a last resort, Golden showed up at Tuesday's oil spill meeting.
Because we don't fall within the Exxon guidelines, we have not been able to receive a dime. We are living on nothing. We're in danger of losing our boat in the middle of August because we can't pay our insurance. I have no money to buy food. I have no money to pay my house payment. Nobody can give us any answers. We're not the only ones out there that have nothing left. Exxon is a giant corporation. We're a small individual group. But we need help. We didn't do anything wrong. But who is going to help us?
Golden later made it clear she was asking for help not only for her family, but for others facing a similar hardship. After she spoke, the city's representative, Wayne Coleman, pointed out that Golden's situation is not unique. Something has to be done, he said. But when Exxon representative John Peavy was contacted, he said Exxon has no plans to broaden their claims policy. He met with Tammy Golden to discuss her situation, but could make no promises to help. Peavy says if Exxon pays one person, it would have to compensate everyone in the same situation. In Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
About 100 state employees gathered in front of the state office building in Fairbanks, picket signs in hand, to hold an informational demonstration. Al Samet is with the board of directors for the northern region of the Alaska State Employees Association.
Actually, all we're asking for is fair negotiations with the Cooper administration. We've saved the state $6 million in health benefits. It was discarded for whatever reasons. We're asking for competent, mature people to talk to us. Until we get this, I think we're going to have demonstrations like this all over the state.
The union employees have been without a contract for 2 years. The last contract was under the old union organization of the Alaska Public Employees Association. Now the ASEA is a local AFSCME chapter. The ASEA has been negotiating for several months with the Cooper administration. Both sides say they are close to contract agreement, but Samet says the last offer from the administration was billed as the bottom line, and it's not good enough.
We've been in negotiations for months. We've been making great headway, and for some reason, the Cooper administration, Mr. Cummings is the chief negotiator for the Cooper administration, and for some reason, he has called off negotiations, or he's made a bottom line offer that's totally unacceptable to state employees.
One of the labor negotiators for the state, Art Chance, says that agreement is close. He says a lot of issues have been cleared away, but now they are down to those that are vitally important. And Chance says the bottom line offer could change.
The administration has given the bottom line, but that doesn't mean that if they come to us with some compelling argument or a meaningful quid pro quo, that won't change. This is a fluid process. I mean, we will bargain with them. That's what the process is. It's a give and take process. With what they have told us, with what they have presented to us, and with what we know of their aims and goals, this is the bottom line. If their aims and goals should change, our position would change to reflect that, I'm certain.
Chance also says that employees have been getting raises based on merit as part of the STEP scale. Chance says 90% of the employees get a 2.5% to 3% increase every year as an annual performance incentive. But even so, it was clear from the employees who demonstrated yesterday that money is the key issue.
We need more money. Absolutely more money. Haven't had a raise since 1985. Okay. Do you think this is going to really accomplish anything, or do you just hear kind of vent some frustration?
Well, it ought to get their attention. That's what we want. We want them to know we're serious.
Quiet, Diane Corso, chief negotiator for the state. Oh, no! Gotta get another one.
Social Security recipients and welfare recipients every year get a raise in their benefits. Yet we continue to work under the same benefits, and I don't think that's fair. Employees who took a break during their lunch hour yesterday say after replacing the old union and going through some turmoil, now they are seeing real action. They had hoped to get the governor's attention and thought they had when his limousine went by, but a spokesperson for his office says the governor was not in the limo and was not aware of the demonstration. They also plan to send postcards to the governor's office, letting him know how they feel. The ASEA represents about 1,000 workers in Fairbanks and more than 7,500 employees statewide. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
When Dennis Slofeld pulled up to the borough landfill last week, he experienced something of a shock.
When I pulled in and he asked me if I knew there was a tipping fee, I sort of chuckled and wondered, you know, you give tips in restaurants, am I supposed to tip them or what? And so I asked him, what's a tipping fee? And he said, well, that means to dump your load. So I was sort of shocked. I was wondering as he said that if I'd brought any money with me because I came unprepared and might have to go back to home to get it.
Starting on August 1st, the borough began for the first time charging residents a $5 tipping fee. According to Stacy Reich, who works at the landfill scales, there have been customers who have left with their load, vowing to use the borough's dumpsters instead, which remain free of charge. It's an idea that had occurred to Dennis Slofeld.
I would say I probably exclusively used the dumpsters. Today I had lumber and brush. Well, I could have built a fire, got a permit, and burned the brush. And the lumber I could have cut up and used in my fireplace, but it was just simpler for me to bring it down here and not go to the trouble. But now that they're charging, I guess I'm going to have to.
But if the August 1st charge was a surprise to the residential junk hauler, the increased fee per ton for commercial and municipal uses of the landfill was staggering. The cost per ton nearly doubled from $21 to $40. In fact, the rates for commercial haulers has increased dramatically since 1986, when use of the landfill was free, funded by the borough through property taxes. In 1986, the company Environmental Recycling was contracted to run the landfill and baling operation. It was Environmental Recycling who then began charging $21 per ton tipping fee. But this June, the borough once again assumed the operation of the landfill and, citing failing equipment and a lack of covering material on the landfill, increased the tipping fee to $40 and instituted the $5 charge to residents. Richard Joy, director of health and safety for the borough, maintains that the increased fee will help make the landfill self-sufficient and avoid passing the economic burden on to the taxpayer.
The idea of the $40 a ton tipping fee is to make it more or less self-sufficient. Back before we entered into the contract with the last landfill contractor, we had funded the landfill operation out of property taxes at about a $1.2 million cost. When we went into the tipping fee, our tax burden for that landfill dropped tremendously to about $100,000 a year. The $40 ton tipping fee allows us to keep that tax burn down in that $100,000 range.
That's not the way Donna Gilbert sees it. She's the president of the Interior Taxpayers Association. She says that the new fees will not only increase the burden on the taxpayer, but will also result in illegal dumping.
If the tipping rate doubles, and it already has actually, we must keep this in mind. It has done that. It'll take effect this month, I believe. So consequently, the only way that the city can cover the cost of the double tipping fees is to double the rate to the people in the city. At the borough level, people that were able to take their garbage out will not have to pay a $5 charge. Unfortunately, they're not going to be able to use the dumpsters because the borough is going to start locking those up, securing them so that people can't use them. And what scares us is that people are going to, instead of paying $5 to go to the dump, not being able to use the dumpster, so on and so forth, we're going to start seeing a landfill over the whole entire borough.
Richard Joy acknowledges that the current situation is difficult. He points out that the borough is in the middle of a transition period between a tax-based and a user fee system. He believes a report the borough is preparing now will suggest ways to resolve the problems.
This report we're doing identifies that and comes up with proposed solutions. Basically, we're hoping by, optimistically, the end of next summer to get to a point where people pay to have their garbage disposed of by either paying somebody to haul it from their door or when they go someplace, whether it's landfill or collection stations, they pay a user fee. Once we get to that point, then we can do things like give people breaks on the tipping fee if they bring in recycle items and things like that. That's laid out in the report also.
But no matter what the final solution to the tipping fee is, two things seem clear. City and borough residents will end up paying more for the disposal of their garbage, and the larger economic and environmental problems associated with solid waste will not go away for some time. For KUAC Local News, I'm Robert Hannon.
This year, we have a student from England. We have folks from the North Slope. We have people from Canada, Lower 48, Winnipeg in Canada. A wide assortment of different people. And the interesting thing that occurred last year and this year is that the line between student and faculty has begun to merge, because we found that the quality of the students we're getting is really so high that they have some very, very important things to offer, both from personal experience as well as from professional training. And so we've included them in what we're doing as partners in this venture. I think it's a unique opportunity for sharing. For instance, the Chernobyl incident. Ludger Mullovy, an anthropologist teaching in the geography department at McGill, has been working with Sami Laplanders for many years, and he has been tracing the effect of reindeer herding, and the most recent effect, of course, being the Chernobyl incident. So he brings that whole perspective, and that then gets compared with reindeer herding in Alaska, and to the extent it's possible for us, we are able to draw some comparisons with the Siberian situation. And interestingly enough, we're very fortunate this year to have Kiosti Urponen from Lapland University, and he came with a whole stack of papers on reindeer herding in Finland. So it's that type of sharing of information that's really critical towards any sort of perspective, I think, on the North. We can't address questions like the greenhouse effect. We can't address questions such as the effects of a Chernobyl-type situation, or even an oil spill situation in the Arctic, without knowing something about the character, the history, the social climate of the communities of the North. And that's what this institute can do. We're not hard physical scientists, but we can give some picture of what life is like in these communities, and that's critical towards any assessment. The amount of business capital needed to successfully run over the long run is so large that most Alaskans don't have that type of business capital. So most of the business capital has come from the outside of Alaska. And that model may also apply for Canada and the Scandinavian countries and Greenland. If it does, that has really important implications in terms of how business is done in the North, and we need to know that in order to understand its effect on human beings. Our conception of this is it's a bit like a toolkit. What does one need to be exposed to, or need in the way of different types of tools for looking at human adaptation in the North? And I'm not here to say that we've got all the tools in the toolkit, but this is an array of some of the tools that are necessary in order to gain a perspective on the North.
This week, Bulgarov and two other Soviet doctors visited the clinic in Kyana and conferred with community health practitioners. Bulgarov says he was impressed with the training and preparation of the clinic staff. He noted that eastern USSR villages like Kyana have their own doctors. Bulgarov says Soviet doctors can learn a lot from their Alaska counterparts.
Обмениваясь мнением и through this exchange program, we've noticed that the medical systems are different, but we're very pleased and we like very much the computer technology that you use to treat these illnesses, and also the way you handle certain problems such as alcoholism and tuberculosis and your immunization system. We're very pleased with this, and we'd like to take that back with us.
And the Soviets can teach Alaskans as well. In fact, they already have, according to Bulgarov.
Already in Anchorage,
there are two Soviet specialists who are teaching the doctors in the Alaska Native Medical Center a new system to treat trauma patients with broken bones, severely broken bones. It was developed by a Soviet doctor named Ilazarov, and the system is called Ilazarov, and it's a new piece of technology that the American delegation to the Soviet Union found out about and were very, very pleased with and very, very impressed, and are now learning to use that in the Native Medical Center. The American doctors, during their trip to the Soviet Union, and even now with their interface with the Soviet doctors, are finding that the Soviets have an interesting means of treating alcoholism. Their system seems to be working very well, and the American doctors want to find out more about this. There's also the system of a mobile clinic throughout the tundra, throughout the villages to follow the reindeer herders that Dr. Larisa Abrutina is working on, and the American doctors have been very impressed with the results of the healthcare throughout the nomadic peoples of the north.
Bulgarov and the other two Soviet doctors visited traditional Eskimo tribal doctors at the Kotzebue Senior Center Wednesday. They plan to return to Nome Monday. In Kotzebue, I'm Jeff Kennedy.
Mr. Sand.
Yeah, that's about as many as are available. There are 73 crews on our list, but for various reasons, several of those crews were not available.
Other communities.
Last year, the Alaska Fire Service paid out over $9 million in wages to these emergency firefighters. That was a record, and last year, of course, was a very bad year for fires.
3, 2, 1. Raul West is the marketing director for the Prince William Sound Tourism Coalition, a little-known group until the Exxon oil spill. West's job since then has been to think of innovative ways to promote the sound despite the oil spill. And while she says she is not trying to minimize the damage from the spill, she is trying to get out the word that less than 20% of Prince William Sound was touched by oil.
Major areas of Prince William Sound that have enjoyed the most popularity with visitors for years and years have not seen any oil. Columbia Glacier, College Fjord, Childs Glacier, Copper River Delta, all of those areas that visitors have enjoyed for years and years are still clean and gorgeous. And we have talked to many visitors this summer who attest to that fact. They're having a great time enjoying sea otters and whales and seals and dolphins just like they always have.
So with the mission in mind to spread the word, West decided to beef up the group's marketing campaign for the season and got some money from Exxon to do it.
Don't let the headlines stop you. Prince William Sound is alive, still thrilling visitors with over $2,000.
$200,000 from Exxon helped the Tourism Coalition launch a major marketing campaign, with these television commercials just one element of that. West says the message was that Prince William Sound is alive, and it seems that people have finally heard it.
Well, I was just in Valdez the other day and was pleased to hear that their tourism was up for July. May and June were pretty poor, but July the visitors were there in good, strong numbers, and that was very good news to hear. And we've also had some very positive response from the press.
West says many newspaper travel sections featured the sound this summer with only good things to say about its looks. And the Tourism Coalition is already working on promotion for 1990. A vacation guide is in the works, as well as a 10-minute video. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
In our deployment of forces abroad, there's talk about moving forces from NATO, and there's talk about moving forces from the Pacific, particularly Korea. And the interesting thing is that we now have demonstrated that if they want a place to park these forces temporarily, this is the place. They could actually come here and be back in either the Western European theater, the NATO theater, or in the Far East, the Pacific theater, in Korea, In about the same amount of time, in about 8 hours, we have three major airports here that could service such transportation. In other words, there's not many places in the world that can offer that kind of capacity. So I think that we're going to continue to try and upgrade these facilities even beyond the capability, beyond the needs of the existing troop deployment. You know, I'm not pushing him or pulling him either way. I didn't with Senator Murkowski. I think each one of us has our own lives and our own interests and our own points of view, and I understood Frank's research and thinking about it, and I understand what Don is talking about, and I think both of them would be excellent governors, but or either one of them be excellent governors. But I also think they're excellent partners back there where I am right now, and I'd be very sad if they decided to, either one of them decided to leave.
3, 2, 1. The idea was to capture all of the uniquely Alaska stories that occur in the state every year, and what a year to start, with so many major stories like the oil spill, cold wave, and the trapped whales. Picking out the big stories was relatively easy. But Luann Nelson says she also included some of the not-so-major stories.
I have little local stories that are just either humorous or noteworthy from a human interest point of view. I've got troopers doing CPR on a moose, fish napping by the Salmon Liberation Organization. I've got a deer that visits a hunting store. He was chased in there by dogs and went down, laid down by the bathroom. And I also have a Bethel health aide who went on a 15-minute trip to deliver medicine to some children, and he ended up getting in a storm and was under his snow machine cover for 17 hours.
After 13 years of teaching in Alaska, Nelson quit her job and took her retirement money to start putting the book together. She wrote the introduction to the 84-page booklet, but the rest of the writing was done by newspaper reporters across the state. She negotiated prices to purchase their stories and also bought numerous pictures to include. One of the most striking is on the front cover, three Eskimos in colorful parkas reaching out to touch a whale trapped in the ice. Nelson says as a novice, she had a lot of cooperation to get the book off the ground, even though she did not have the experience.
I ran into people who weren't real sure about me because they sometimes they'd say, well, what's your experience? And I said, well, I made books with my first graders, and I was editor of the high school yearbook. So there were people who, although I didn't have people turn me down, there was some hesitancy about how this was going to turn out. And I've just, the overwhelming comment when people take a look at this, being self-published and made in Alaska, is they're just really impressed with the quality.
Now that the premier edition of Alaska Review is off the press, Nelson is already planning next year's version.
Oh, I have in the back of the book, I have asked for people to send contributions and submissions of stories and photos, and I hope to expand not just to published material, because I know some of the best stories in Alaska never make it to the press. I'd like to produce an unpublished material, factual stories, if that's possible to get a factual story in Alaska.
The biggest job now is selling the book to businesses, since she already missed the tourist season. She had 5,000 copies printed and estimates that she sold about 1,500 in the last week since the book has been out.
I have missed the tourist season, but one of the things that I'm banking on as far as this book is I think it's going to make a tremendously nice gift for, you know, people to send a little bit of Alaska home, because it really gives you a feel for what happened in the state, as well as, you know, not only the international headline news, but a lot of the funny little stories that come about from the type of environment that we live in.
She's still a one-woman operation, though. She took on the project herself and continues to promote and sell it herself.
I usually start out by saying I'm Luann Nelson with Alaska Review, and then if I decide to get honest, I tell them I am Alaska Review.
Nelson says after traveling the state to sell the book, she might try her marketing techniques in the lower 48. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. Since Since the summer program has been in operation, as many as 15 children show up for an average day at Tickasick Brown. On this particular morning, only 9 children are here, but they are an active and vocal group. Some of them are practicing their woodworking skills. The students range in age from 5 to 11. The adult supervisor who spends her days with the children, Marty Mogensen, says they spend the time doing a variety of things.
Pretty much we've been running the summer as a summer camp program and a lot of outdoor activities and field trips and that sort of thing. And then during the fall, it will continue as a before and after school program. And that was recently approved by the school district as a type of pilot program. So Tickasick Brown is the first school in the Fairbanks area to go ahead with that.
Back in 1986, a school-age child care committee studied the need for school-age child care in the Fairbanks North Star Borough and found that before and after school child care was needed. SAFE was formed and got the approval to run the pilot program this summer to see how well the idea would work. At least one of the youngsters at Tickasick Brown seems to think it was a good idea.
It's fun, it's great, it has a lot of neat things, and we're happy to have it.
SAFE runs its operation like any child care provider. It's licensed by the state, can take a maximum of 30 students, and has fees and rules for parents who enroll their children in the program. The fact that it's provided in the school itself provides an easy solution for parents who can drop off their child before they go to work and pick them up after work. Kathleen Owens is a foster grandparent who comes in to read and play with the children. It keeps them entertained, and she gets to spend some time with the younger generation.
My children are all grown up and gone, and it's kind of nice to introducing them to new things, and I don't know, just falling in love with them, that's all.
Today is the last day of the summer program. After this, SAFE will resume child care with the before and after school program when school starts this fall. That was approved on a pilot program basis while the school board looks at the issue more thoroughly. Many questions need to be addressed by the board if such programs are going to become more common. The board wants a policy in place that will take into consideration its role in child care if the school district wants a role at all. Answers to those questions will be explored before child care in the public schools is something that will occur slowly district-wide. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
Have that theme is we want to honor the people who over the years have done a lot for the fair. And for years, many years, long before I came around, there's been a clown corps here at the fair. And always there's some of the clowns on the grounds entertaining people. And we are honoring them. And that was our theme. It looks good out here at the fairgrounds. The grounds are nice, nice and green. Right now we're building the city. The fair city, and by 4 o'clock, everything is supposed to be ready.